This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Good morning and welcome into another edition of Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. My name is Alex Reamer. We have a very interesting and informative show for all of you this week. Have two of our favorite returning guests who will join us momentarily. As you all know, this month, September, is National Suicide Prevention Month. We started that conversation a couple of weeks ago. Want to revisit it this week with an old friend of ours who used to hear on these airwaves all the time, Trenny Kuznarek. You can watch, of course, nightly on NBC Sports Boston. Now, Trenny has been very outspoken about mental health and her own battles with mental health over the years. We had her on a couple months ago to talk about her own struggles. This week, though, she comes back to talk about a panel that she hosted a few days ago at Suffolk University on mental illness and professional athletes. She moderated it alongside Congressman Joe Kennedy, Brad Stevens, Troy Brown, and ex-college basketball superstar Shamiqua Holdsclaw were all on the panel. A very illuminating discussion. Shamiqua, for those of you who did not watch it, I highly recommend you go back and watch it. Frankly, for her, she was great, very open about her battle with bipolar disorder and how she's dealt with that through the years and her evolution in coping with that. And Brad Stevens and Troy Brown are illuminating as well. Troy had a story about Junior Seau and how gregarious he was in the locker room. He was a leader who everyone went through. And then, of course, we know how it ended for him. It's just a reminder that you truly don't know what's going on with somebody inside of their head. So a great panel discussion moderated by Trenny. She joined us for her biggest takeaways from that. One of my biggest takeaways was statistics cited by Joe Kennedy. The three largest psychiatric care facilities in the United States are prisons. That's right. The three largest psychiatric care facilities in this country are prisons. And you talk about mental health issues as a whole. I've been fairly open about my not struggles, I don't think is the wrong word, but I've battled anxiety on and off throughout my life. And I've been fortunate enough to have parents who were able to pay out of pocket and send me to therapists. And I went to a great center at Boston University a few years ago, Boston University Center for Anxiety, where they helped me with a lot of this stuff, obsessive compulsive disorder, etc. And those treatment centers were great. I got a lot of help. I still use the skills I learned there today in my everyday life. But you had to pay out of pocket, and it certainly was not cheap. And I'm fortunate enough where I had parents who were financially able to spend as much money as it took for me to get the treatment and help that I needed. So many people, though, are not in that situation, especially if you're talking about folks from lower-income neighborhoods, and especially if you're talking about addiction. Trenny and I talk about this in our conversation. You go to rehab centers, it's $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. It is certainly not cheap. And then you have a situation where prisons are serving as our psychiatric care facilities. Police officers are doubling as social workers. Security guards, prison guards are doubling as social workers. And it's just not what they signed up to do. And frankly, it's unfair to them. So it's a very nasty situation. So again, a good talk with Trenny about that. And also at the end of our conversation, we briefly touched upon the Josh Gordon signing and how that coverage has been framed. With Josh Gordon, I think there are two issues. There's the football aspect of it. Do you think he can contribute to the Patriots? And then there's, how is he being framed? You know, how is he being framed coming into the Patriots? Because it's very tempting to lump him in with Aaron Hernandez and Albert Haynesworth and Corey Dillon and other guys who have been brought in here with violent, and in Hernandez's case, murderous track records and rap sheets. And I've even been guilty of it in the past. But it's lazy and it's wrong, because I don't think it's right to make that comparison between Gordon and other guys the Patriots have brought in here with real violent past. So long story short, we talk about all that stuff with Trenny. And then after that, we check in with Kelly Eisner, who is a spokeswoman for the Red Cross. We had the explosions in the Merrimack Valley last week. Still lots of cleanup to be done. The Red Cross is helping out there. And Kelly and I go back and forth about the recovery efforts and how you can get involved if you would like. It's Boston Community Affairs and WEEI. So Trenny Kuznarek and Kelly Eisner coming up next. Thank you, as always, for listening. And welcome back. It's Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. We haven't heard this voice on our airwaves in a while. Trenny Kuznarek from NBC Sports Boston. Trenny, how are you?
I'm well, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. So want to have you on this week because September, of course, is a National Suicide Prevention Month, and we've done a couple of shows already based on this theme, but this, of course, is a great month to bring a lot of these topics back to the forefront. This past Monday, you hosted a panel discussion with Suffolk on mental illness and professional athletes. It was moderated by yourself and my congressman, I'll take credit for him, Joe Kennedy, along with Brad Stevens, Troy Brown, and Shamiqua Holdsqua. I had a very illuminating conversation, lots of personal stories going back and forth. What was your biggest takeaway from the event on Monday? And also, how did that come together?
Well, I'll start with the second question first. It came together because in 2016, Kevin Paul DuPont from the Boston Globe wrote a column on me during May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month,
right?
About my issues with anxiety and depression. And Congressman Joe Kennedy actually sent me a handwritten post, like a little note. And I remember seeing it in my mailbox at NBC and being like, wow, why did I get something from the congressman? And like immediately being like, oh God, did I do something wrong? Am I in trouble with the law?
Right.
And opening it up and being so flattered that he, you know, thought enough one to read it and then thought enough to reach out to me and commend me for speaking out and saying how passionate he was about these issues. And so someone at my, who works at NBC was like, you know, you should contact his press secretary and just see if the two of you can meet and discuss these issues. So we met in the fall of 2016. And ever since then, we've met periodically just to try to discuss mental health issues, coverage, advocacy, lobbying for better coverage. And we just wanted to put something together that might shed some light on it, but also involve athletes because Joe's a big sports fan, one. And two, he knows the power of those voices. You know, we hold our athletes in really high regard. And we also, I think, look at them as larger than life and people who may not deal with the same things that quote unquote regular people deal with. And so I just suggested maybe we do a panel. Could we pull it together? So this has been probably a year in the making. I asked Brad if he'd be interested in participating, last summer at an event that Jackie McMullen held for her, a charity she works with. And he said yes immediately. And so just kind of got the ball rolling and it all came to fruition and it was amazing. As for my biggest takeaway, I was really impressed by the number of people who were interested in attending and who showed up. It was sold out,
yeah.
The wait list for the event. And people I think are really passionate about this topic, whether publicly or privately. And I think they're really interested in learning more about it. And the response we got afterwards was really thankful. You know, there are a lot of people out there and athletes and broadcasters included who may not be ready to share their stories, but it still helps them to hear other people talk about it. And it just really, I think, helps people that are in, you know, regular day-to-day life realize that they're not alone.
Yeah, and I think that totally rings true. And whenever you have the people of this stature come out, it lessens the stigma. And, you know, one of the big takeaways I had from watching it was Troy Brown talking about Junior Seau. We've heard these stories before, but for Troy to say this was a guy who was a leader in the locker room, who was a gregarious personality, everybody went to him, it really just goes to show that you don't truly know what's going on with somebody. And I think that's a powerful message, too, because I remember Shamiqua also said that she, you know, speaks to parents at certain events and they say, oh, my kid drives a Mercedes. What's he upset for? So it just hammers home the point that it's more than the outside. It's more than material. Again, you don't truly know what's going on with somebody.
Yeah, that's something I always try to stress when I speak to, you know, whether they're students or parents or educators and even clinicians is, you know, somebody may look on the outside like they completely have it together. I mean, I don't think when I was in my early 20s, I always sort of struggled like a low-lying anxiety, but it really sort of peaked in my early 20s. And I don't think anyone would have ever looked at me and said, she goes home at night and cries herself to sleep and sometimes doesn't want to leave her house because she just can't find the energy. Like I was a reporter, I was on TV, I was sociable, I would go out, I'd have a good time. Like I was always the life of the party. But what, you know, the mask, and Shamiqua talked a lot about this, right? Like putting that mask on when you're in front of people. And then when you go home, it's an entirely different person. And I think that's easier to do now too, right? With social media, like how many of us can put, like, I personally know friends who are really struggling with things, but if you look at their social media, it's like, I'm having a great time. I'm so successful. My family is great. My job is great. My life is great. But, you know, these are often the people that I'll get text messages or direct messages from that are like, hey, I'm really struggling. I'm not sleeping. I'm not doing this. Like, what did you do? What can I do? I just feel a little lost here. So, you know, I guess it sort of like harkens back to that old saying that, you know, you be kind to everyone because you never know, you know, what kind of battles people are fighting.
Yeah, it absolutely is true. And about how we frame this conversation, I think it was Brad Stevens who brought this up about social media, how everything is off the cuff. And, you know, one of the things about social media is we are seeing a lot more mental health awareness. Obviously, again, September is National Suicide Prevention Month, and folks like yourself are very outspoken. But in general, someone who is outspoken about this and sees a lot of the conversation, what are some things that what are your general thoughts about how these mental health issues are framed publicly? Like, let's say when a famous person like Anthony Bourdain commits suicide, and there's a lot of talk about it, and I think a lot of people try to say good things and try to offer their support, but just, I know this was touched on briefly in the panel, but what are your general thoughts with how a lot of these issues are framed?
I think it's getting better, right? Like, I think that by and large, most people have developed an empathy that maybe wasn't there 5 or 10 mm-hmm. years ago, and a better understanding that this is something real. This isn't something that you can just take a walk or go for a run or, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and have a better attitude and make it go away. So I think on that end, it's gotten better. I think people try to be compassionate and understanding about it. But there is still, I would say, 20% part of the population, maybe even I, is 30% of the population that just can't wrap their brain around it, for lack of a better phrase. And they see especially when we're talking about suicide, I think that mental health and mental illness has, the dialogue around it has changed, but for whatever reason, it hasn't caught up as quickly to suicide. And a lot of times what we see when somebody, you know, dies from suicide is they were selfish. Why did they do this? Mm-hmm. They didn't care about anyone but themselves. They, you know, good riddance to them. They shouldn't have been here anyway. I mean, just like terrible, terrible things, not ever thinking about, one, people's family members may read those comments. I remember when Robin Williams passed away, his daughter had to get off of social media because people were saying such terrible things about the way that he died, instead of trying to better understand like the depths of this disease and maybe talking to someone who maybe has had suicidal ideations or has attempted but survived suicide to, you know, understand what led them to that point. There's still a really like visceral reaction to suicide.
Yeah, no, there most certainly is. And another big takeaway I had from the panel was Joe Kennedy brought the stat up that the three largest psychiatric treatment centers in the country are prisons. I mean,
yes, in Chicago, LA, and was the other one New York?
Yeah, I think it was New York City. Yeah, I mean, that is that speaks to a lot of the problem right there. And the U.S., of course, has the largest percentage of its population that's incarcerated in the entire world. And you talk about addiction and the lack of, and you talked about this too, and Joe Kennedy talked about this. Like, you know, I, for example, struggled with anxiety growing up. I'm fortunate enough to have parents who were able to pay out of pocket for treatment, were able to send me to something like the BU Center for Anxiety, which helped me a lot. But a lot of people don't have those options. And I think Kennedy also mentioned that there's so many counties in this country don't even have a licensed social worker in them at all. So it's the access just seems so cut off. And as we mentioned, it seems like they're being funneled towards the prisons, especially low-income people.
Yeah, 55% of counties in the United States have no psychiatrist, psychologist, or licensed clinical social worker available to them. And so what happens is, and I think this happens a lot of times in more extreme cases of mental illness, maybe schizophrenia, bipolar, manic depressives, where it may cause you to act out in a way that you may not even remember. Shamiqua talked about her own personal experience. She ended up being diagnosed bipolar, but I don't think at the time she knew it, or she did, and she, you know, her medication wasn't quite right, or she had stopped taking her medication, and she had a manic episode where she blacked out and she brandished a gun, her own personal weapon, on her then girlfriend in a car. And she was indicted on like 5 or 7 felonies. And the conversation around her at the time wasn't, you know, what caused her to do this, what's going on. It was, she's a criminal, she's just another kid, you know, who was, you know, brought up without parents, who ended up on the wrong side of the law. There wasn't a compassionate conversation around it. And I think all too often, we don't have law enforcement. And listen, we can only expect so much of our law enforcement. I want to make sure to say that. But we don't have people that are going to these incidents with any sort of psychology background. So you're sending in, you know, two officers or one officer who is a well-trained officer, but isn't trained in mental health issues. You know, and how much can we expect of these? Of our officers.
It's unfair to them, frankly.
It's unfair to them. Like, they, you know, they're not paid to be psychologists and social workers and defend the public and protect and serve everyone, right? And I think that's the issue, is that when they go into these situations, maybe they don't know how to handle them properly, or even if they do handle them, there's nowhere. Once you arrest someone and you realize, okay, this person, you know, isn't violent necessarily, but they are dealing with some sort of mental health issue, where do you put them? Hospital beds are full. We really don't have mental health facilities anymore. They're very few and far between. Beds are often full, and you can only get in them if you can afford to pay for them. So where you end up? You end up in jail. And then you're not getting any kind of services. You're not getting medications. You're not getting diagnosed. Things aren't taken care of. And then it's just this really vicious cycle where then you're put back out on the streets. And if you're not getting treated for your mental illness, then these patterns repeat themselves. It's just really sad, and you know, it's really unfortunate. I know that back in the 60s, I believe it actually was, ironically, President Kennedy, who really spearheaded the closing of a lot of these institutions because so many of the patients were abused and the conditions were so poor. But unfortunately, they were never replaced. There was never anything substituted for them except for our emergency rooms and our jails. So that is something we need to fix.
What would be a solution for that, though?
I mean, a solution I would think would be, at this point, you know, we have so much more oversight now, Alex, and like, I mean, you know, have wings of hospitals or have hospitals built that are, I mean, we have cancer care centers, right? We have places where people can go. We have dialysis centers. We should have mental health centers. We should have a place to go where people can receive treatment that is covered by insurance and that doesn't cost them their lives. And listen, this is obviously a tough battle. I mean, we see it especially with addiction. If you don't have the money to pay to put your kid or yourself or your spouse or brother or sister, whatever, into rehab, you have to pay out of pocket. And it's not cheap. You know, six weeks, a month or something, 30 days in rehab, you're talking sometimes $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. There's not a lot of families who just have that lying around. And, you know, Joe and I talked about this, Joe Kennedy and I talked about this really early in our discussions, that what has to change is there has to be a movement. There was a movement with AIDS. There was a movement with cancer. There's been movements to a lesser degree with like heart disease and diabetes, where people come together and they tell their stories and they're open and honest about them. And that's why getting rid of these stigmas are so important, because once you get rid of those, people might feel more comfortable telling their story. And if they feel more comfortable telling their story, they feel better coming together with other people in order to force legislators to pay attention to what's going on and change it.
Yeah, and maybe that movement is starting with all the folks who are outspoken. Last topic here I want to hit on you with, and it ties into the addiction conversation. Josh Gordon, of course, acquired by the Patriots. You all know his issues. I separate the Gordon coverage into two instances, right? So there's the football part of it. Do you not think he can contribute? That's separate. But then there's the other part of it where he gets lumped in with Albert Haynesworth and Aaron Hernandez and Corey Dillon and these guys with real violent rap sheets. And me personally, I even caught myself doing this in the first article I wrote about it. I actually went back and edited it and said, wait a minute, I don't really feel comfortable including him with these guys. What are your thoughts on how Gordon's so-called off-field problems have been framed and throwing him in like so many have? And again, I was guilty of it too. It's hard not to do it because it's easy to just rattle them all off, but they are different in terms of the issues he's dealt with. And again, these guys who have come in with violent and real criminal rap sheets.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that we have not heard about Josh Gordon, we've never heard someone say this is a bad kid, right? This is a kid who has violent tendencies or who, you know, isn't kind to others. I mean, his issues, which started in middle school, if you read the GQ article.
Yeah, seventh grade, yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic, where he talks about how he was self-medicating as early as middle school. We do, and I've tried really hard, and I'm sure like you have slipped into just generalizations, but I've tried really hard in all the conversations I've had this week about Josh Gordon to frame the conversation about like, listen, let's not compare him to everyone else. What he's dealing with is different.
Right.
Now, is there still a question of whether or not football's the best thing for him? That's my question. Is it best for him? Would it be best for him to get paid still his contract, but have the NFL require him to go through like a really long and very intensive treatment period? Maybe, but he is a grown man and he has to make his own choices. And the way that things are set up in our country, you can't force anyone to get treatment that they, you know, don't want to get voluntarily. My hope is that being on the Patriots and having some structure and maybe having people who care, you know, that maybe really do take a genuine interest in him and his overall health will help be that thing that turns the tide. And that's kind of how I've tried to frame the conversation. Like, let's talk about this person as a human being who, again, hasn't done anything criminal, has enacted violently towards women or children or even his own teammates, but instead has dealt with really intense mental health issues since he was a preteen or a teenager, and he has an illness. And how do you manage that illness so that he can still be successful and a you know, contributing piece of society? So I don't know. I hope, like, there's such a part of me that wants him to succeed here and get better at the same time. I don't know if that's possible.
Right, I agree.
I mean, hope it is, though.
Right. I mean, I was saying, you know, if you have in August, you're taking a leave from camp for mental health issues, and then, you know, you're benched before week two, and then you come here, and just because you see the 5 Super Bowl banners, all your problems are cured. I don't think it works
right
that way. But, you know, like Peter King on our airwaves yesterday said something. He said, you know, Josh Gordon is not worthy of the Patriots. I'm like,
right,
wait a minute. I mean, Aaron Hernandez played for the Patriots. That's the kind of stuff that I was hoping.
Yeah,
we wouldn't
I'm
hear
not gonna lie.
Of.
That what Peter King said really bothered me, because this is someone who is, again, he's not Greg Hardy. Greg Hardy was not worthy of playing in the NFL. Josh Brown was not worthy of playing in the NFL. Ray Rice was not worthy of playing in the NFL. You know, the list could go on of different sports and different people aren't worthy based on their actions off the field. But to me, someone who's dealing with addiction and mental health issues, they struggle with their own self-worth. We don't need to make it worse.
Trenny Kuznarek, you can watch her every night on NBC Sports Boston. Trenny, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
All right, talk soon.
And welcome back to Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. In the phone line right now, we have one of our returning champions, Kelly Eisner. She is the External Communications Manager for Red Cross. Kelly, how are you? Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
No problem. Always good to chat. And you guys, the Red Cross, continue to do great work. The last week or so have been very busy, a little north of the city, the Merrimack Valley, after the gas explosions there. What is the Red Cross doing to help, and what more remains? I know that the explosions happened late last week, but they're still discovering injuries. It still seems like there's still a lot of work to be done up there.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, thankfully, the first responders were so on top of things. It is amazing to me that was, you know, it was a horrible situation, and everyone just was so quick to respond. Even, I mean, I saw a video of firefighters that had lost their own homes and were still going out and helping the community and warning other people to get out. I saw videos online of, you know, people showing you how to turn off your own gas. Really just an incredible team effort by everyone involved. Thankfully, we're the initial, kind of the first wave of response is winding down now. So what the Red Cross is doing is we are meeting with the towns that were involved, Lawrence Andover and North Andover, to see what they need from us moving forward. I know we've been, you know, it's all about supporting some of the resource centers that are already there. MEMA has resource centers to help care for people that were displaced. Right now, MEMA has a resource center at 652 Andover Street in Lawrence that's open. There's a claim center. You know, there's several of those. So basically what the Red Cross does now is we're providing food supplies. We're making ourselves available to the communities. One of the things that our teams will be doing, our volunteers, will be just providing mental health support because, you know, after an event like this, you can clean up the physical effects, but the emotional effects really last for a long time. So a big part of the support the Red Cross provides is getting people who have been affected in touch with professionals that can help them begin recovery, so making those mental health contacts.
That's a good point. Yeah, you don't mention that, because when you think of gas explosions, obviously you think of the physical damages to the homes. But yeah, I imagine the mental effect is such a huge thing, with people wondering, is my house just going to blow up now if I live in that area?
Sure. I mean, and it's it's something that stays with you for years to come. We've made, as of Wednesday, we had made 250 contacts between, you know, people looking for that kind of emotional support and mental health professionals, health and mental health professionals.
Wow. So would you say that's the biggest challenge facing that area now that we are about a week and a half away from the explosions, the traumatic effects afterwards that folks may be experiencing?
I mean, it's definitely a big part of it. It's not to downplay the physical effects because, I mean, people lost their homes. They've lost their, you know, everything they had in those homes, too.
Right.
I mean, there's so much cleanup and so much recovery still to be done. You know, in the days following the explosions, I think the numbers here, we had more than 1,200 people just stay overnight at one of our shelters. We had four shelters open in the area. And as always, those shelters stay open until they're not needed anymore.
Do you know roughly how many people are still in those shelters?
As of right this moment, I don't have that number. It was 1,222 as of last night.
Wow.
1,222? In other words, so if someone stays for four nights, that's technically counted as four stays. But
okay,
over
still.
Those four shelters.
Wow. Still a very high total, and this is happening just right around in the greater Boston area. What's the best way that people can help, Kelly? They hear this interview, they hear about the great work Red Cross does, and I mentioned helping Merrimack Valley. What's the best way for the average citizen to get involved?
The biggest help is always going to be a financial donation. You know, it's so generous that people want to do everything they can, but and even though it's with the best of intentions, we can't really take donations of clothes, old clothes or shoes or food, things like that. We encourage people not to bring those items to a Red Cross shelter or to any other Red Cross location, just because of the logistical challenges involved in cleaning them and sorting through them. So again, a financial donation is the best way to help. An easy way to do that is if you text Red Cross to 90999, that will automatically make a $10 donation to the Red Cross. You can also go on redcross.org and find out the different ways to donate there as well.
You mentioned the monetary donations, Kelly. In the aftermath of any event like this, you see some fraudulent charities popping up. I saw a couple pop up on social media in the immediate aftermath of the Merrimack Valley explosions. In general, what are the best ways to identify or vet something you may see on social media? It says donate money to help out the Merrimack Valley when that may not be legitimate. What are some of the best ways that you can identify and kind of sift through that and know which charities are legitimate and which ones are scams?
Well, thankfully, there are third-party agencies that do a lot of vetting of charity. Charity Navigator is one that comes to mind for me. There are others as well. As far as the Red Cross is concerned, we, 91 cents of every dollar that is donated goes directly to helping disaster relief efforts and helping humanitarian missions. I feel confident donating to the Red Cross on a personal level as well.
Yes, 91 cents in every dollar. It's 91%. I'm not a math major, but I can figure that out even. lastly here, Kelly, I know that Hurricane Florence happened, not in Massachusetts, several states south of our border here, but that's something that you guys are helping out with as well. How's that going?
Sure. I mean, as of the latest numbers I have, 28 counties in North Carolina are still under evacuation orders. In one county, we had as many as 700 people that had to be evacuated because of dam failures. Right now, I think there's this initial idea that once the storm is over, the danger is over, and that's just not the case because the flooding is going to, they're expecting it to continue into next week. You know, the rivers crest their banks. Some of these rivers could stay at flood stage for weeks. And flooding is one of those, it's really difficult to recover from when everything gets wet. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of help needed there for a long time. One of the things, too, that I think I always mention that people in this area can do to help, obviously a financial donation is a huge support. You can also donate blood. We had, you know, because of the pending storms, you know, we had to cancel nearly 200 blood drives down in that area. That means that more than 5,000 blood and platelet donations that we otherwise would have collected went uncollected. I mean, thankfully, the Red Cross is big enough that we can try to move blood down there in advance when we know something's coming. We can shift the supply, but that supply needs to be replenished. So, you know, if blood went from Massachusetts down to the Carolinas, then you can give blood in Massachusetts and it'll put it back on the shelves. And that's the case everywhere.
Excellent. Yes, you don't think of that, but there are certainly ways that we can help out up here, even though it didn't happen in our state or around our borders. Kelly Osner, she's External Communications Manager for Red Cross. Great information as always. Kelly, thanks for coming on, and I'm sure we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you so much, Alex, and thank you to everyone listening.
So thank you again for tuning in to Boston Community Affairs, and thanks to two of our returning champions, Trenny Kuznarek and Kelly Eisner, for joining me on the show this week. As always, if you want to contribute to the conversation, send me an email, alexr@weei.com. I'm always taking recommendations on issues you would like to hear discussed. So long, everybody. Again, thank you for listening. We will talk to you next week. Have a great rest of your weekend.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.